This week's show was recorded as a video show with the folks at the Royal School of Needlework. And then I extracted the audio track to make an audio podcast for those who prefer to listen to audio only. As we go through the show, there's a lot of reference to images, obviously, because that's what we were doing on the video thing. If you want to listen to this audio podcast on the page for the podcast, I have put a slideshow of all of the images that we looked at in the order that we talked about them in the video. And I've also inserted the video on the FiberTalk, WeTalkFiber.com page for this podcast, so you can just watch it there, or you can go watch it at our YouTube channel. So three options for you: listen audio and use the slideshow, watch the video on the FiberTalk podcast page for this show, or go to the YouTube channel and watch the video there. A little bit different this week, but essential so that we can share with you all the work that the Royal School of Needlework did for the various pieces for the coronation. However you listen to the show, we hope you enjoy it and are as impressed as we were with the tremendous work that they do at the Royal School of Needlework. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. And actually, this week you're listening and or watching. We have the ladies from Hampton Court Palace in the UK, from the Royal School of Needlework. On your left is Gemma Murray, and in the center, Ann Butcher, and on the right, the good Dr. Susan K. Williams. So we have a special show this week. And very excited to almost a year to the date of the coronation of King Charles III. And we're going to learn the role that the Royal School played in restoring, rejuvenating, and creating embroidery and textile arts for the coronation. And very excited. These ladies were so kind to make time to talk to us and share what their experiences were. So that, because the coronation, you know, we watch it on TV and we see it on the news, and we get to enjoy all the finished product. But what goes on behind it when it comes to embroidery is, I think, equally fascinating. So thanks to you guys for making the time. Let's start over here on the left, Gemma. What role did you play in the operation, and what is your title and so on at the Royal School?
Yeah, so I have the privilege of being studio manager for the Royal School of Needlework Embroidery Studio, and I work alongside Anne, and we oversaw the completion of 9 projects for His Majesty's coronation. A fantastic opportunity, one that I will treasure always, and a real once-in-a-lifetime treat to work on.
Yep, and Anne, your role?
So I'm head of studio and standards for the Royal School of Needlework. I obviously worked with Gemma. We worked alongside a whole team of embroiderers to produce the 9 pieces for the coronation. And again, certainly an experience I will never forget.
Yes, I'm sure of that. All right, Susan, we've talked to you so many times, we don't need to introduce you, but you know the history. Tell us the history of the Royal School and the coronations, and just give us a little background.
I will. I'll do the quick 5-minute run through, because we worked on all 4 coronations of the 20th century. The first one was 1902 for Edward VII, where we made the mantle that he wore at the moment of being crowned, and we made the canopy under which he was anointed, and the Queen was also anointed for that one. Then in 1911, we made an altar dorsal, which goes behind an altar and above it, and designed that as well. And we also made what's known as the Stole Royal, of which you'll hear more later. But that's a gift to the monarch from one of the London livery companies, and they asked us to make it for George V in 1911. Then in 1937, well, we made a whole raft of different things, including the Queen's robe of estate, the one she wears to leave the Abbey, various chairs, various banners, and the crests for both the King and the Queen, really, again, another large group of pieces. And then in 1953, Queen Elizabeth II asked us to design and to make her robe of estate, again, the train that she wore as she left the Abbey, and we put together three different designs from which she chose one, and then we embroidered all of it in what's known as coronation gold work in a pattern known as Peace and Plenty, combining olive branches and wheat ears. So that was our history, in a nutshell, of the last four coronations.
Yeah. Now, when it comes to embroidered pieces for a coronation, are you guys the go-to place, or are there other people who contribute embroidered pieces, or are you the primary source?
I think we have become the primary source.
Okay.
For two of our hallmarks, really, that we can do things to a timetable, no matter how tight that timetable is. And also we can have a team of people working collectively, and yet it will look like the work of one person. And that's not something that many other organizations can achieve. So, yes, I think we are the go-to people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a tremendous strength that you have. Yes. All right. So take us through, Anne or Gemma, take us through the timeline. We established the date for the coronation. Then how does this stuff come to you? Is it in bits and pieces, or does somebody show up with a list for you?
No, it tends to come in bits and pieces. I mean, we never assumed that we would be working on pieces for the coronation. We obviously dreamed and hoped, of course, but with a 70-year gap, you know, we weren't 100% sure. You find that as each piece is agreed, then they will come to you. We will be approached by the relevant parties, and then they start the discussions. We'll have discussions about the processes and how things are going to be produced and what techniques we would use. And that all gets put into motion. And it's kind of the same process that we would use for any of our commissions or anybody that comes to visit us with a project. It's that same process. It's just as and when each of the pieces was ready to discuss, they would then come out to us.
Okay. Now, are you always working with the royal family, or are you working with different entities in the kingdom? I guess I don't know.
our customers are quite varied. So anywhere from churches, obviously through to royalties, fashion houses, interior designers. But we have an awful lot of private customers that will come to us with treasured family pieces, often with the most amazing stories behind them. So our client pool, our customers, are really wide and varied.
But even for these pieces, I think it was that different people came to us at different times. So some came directly from the royal household, and some came to us via either intermediaries or by those who were commissioning the pieces.
Okay, so you really don't know who's going to come to you until they show up. Okay, yeah, that's what I was trying to get at. Is do you have a central person, or are you getting hit from? So when you started this thing, you really didn't have any clue to how many pieces you would ultimately prepare.
No, we didn't. Not at all.
Now there's two types of pieces, as I understand it. There's ones that you're restoring or spiffing up, I guess, and then there's things that you are creating from scratch. What did you deal with there?
So a real mix. I mean, as a studio, we're a little bit different to a lot, because we do conservation, restoration, and bespoke pieces of embroidery. And through the nine pieces, we were able to showcase our skills in each of those areas. So His Majesty's Red Robe was conserved. When we came to do the throne chairs, they were restored by a process called transferring. And then obviously the new pieces were bespoke designed for the event. So we were able to showcase every element that we can offer, which was amazing to be able to do that. And as I say, it truly shows us as a slightly different studio with a greater capacity to do things.
Yeah.
And our team of expert embroiderers allow us to do that. So we're very, very fortunate to have that team and that resource to pull on.
Now, I'm fascinated by the nuts and bolts here. So when you get a project like this and then not knowing what you're ultimately going to have to deal with, my first thought is, do you have enough supplies in-house? Are you going to have to line up a bunch of materials from your normal suppliers? How did you work with that? I mean, that had to be on the fly too, if you're not getting everything all at once.
A little bit, but we're very fortunate here. We do have a large stock of threads and fabrics and things like that. So we try and draw on that to start with, because we keep a stock of new threads for students to use. So we have those on site. We have some really good suppliers that we work closely with, so we're able to go out to them. And some of the pieces, as you'll hear about a little bit later, they had supplies that came in via a third party. So like an upholsterer was dealing with the fabric for the chairs, that sort of situation. So it was quite a mix, but we're really fortunate that we can draw on a stock that we already have here. And, you know, from a sustainable point of view, we try and do that. We try not to buy in unless we really have to.
Yeah. Okay. And do you say to the suppliers, hey, this is for the coronation, put it at the top of your list?
No, we are known for our absolute discretion. So okay. We did say pretty please.
Oh, okay. Because, I mean, that would be a big hammer to wield there if you just showed up. Yeah. But so then generally you have enough supplies in-house that you can handle just about everything.
Yeah, we have a massive stock. We're very lucky because we received donations from people as well, from threads and fabrics from their own collection. So our stocks are continually growing, and it's ideal. And as Anne said, with sustainability, that was absolute core with a lot of the projects. So to be able to draw from our resources and use things without having to purchase was absolutely brilliant. So it is a bit of a hoarder's paradise down in the studio, but... And it serves its purpose perfectly. So, yeah.
Yeah. All right, Beth and I will be right over to enjoy. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So we have supplies, and you know you can get supplies, but I mean that's got a tremendous number of people to pull these things off in what is relatively a short time. I mean, we all stitch, and we all know how long these things take, and these are in some cases massive pieces. Tell us how you work the personnel end of things, because that's got to be a challenge, just coordinating.
It is a challenge, but the way that we train our embroiderers, so anybody that's been through the apprenticeship, as Gemma and myself went through, or the Future Tutor Program, soon to become the Professional Embroiderers Tutor Program, we train everybody in a similar way. So everybody works in a similar way. Their grounding techniques are the same, as well as the more complicated techniques. So we're able to draw on that pool of embroiderers to increase the core team that we have in the studio. And then they have those skills to bring with them. They're all practicing professionals. So that means also that they bring additional skills, as we all do, to the table, so to speak, so that we can draw on that. So we are really, really fortunate. And as Susan mentioned earlier, that means that we can put multiple people onto one piece of work and it still look like one person's work. And that is one of the big things that we are known for. And it's so, so important in situations such as this.
Yeah, we'll see in some of the pictures later where we have multiple ladies working on a piece, and the close-ups, it really shows you can't tell who's there's no difference. It's always so impressive to me that you can bring bodies together like that and work at such a high level, and it looks like one person's but sitting there for hours. Yeah.
I think those that have worked in the studio as well, they have an ability to adjust themselves slightly to make sure that they work in in the same way. So everybody just is flexible enough to do that.
Yeah. So how does it work personnel wise? Say we've got one of the robes, one of the trains we're going to work on. How does that work? Does everybody come in and take a turn, or we work in shifts? How does that all play out?
A lot of careful planning. Gemma and I spend a lot of time planning staff and scheduling staff, and we go out to the team, we go out to the pool, and we ask for availability. And because obviously a lot of our tutors who came back in and helped on this project are also freelance, so they have commitments as well. So it's very much finding out everybody's availability and then working from there. And then obviously as we reviewed each project, just seeing how many people we needed, how many staff, and that would change from project to project or from month to month, to be honest. So it was very much a movable feast. I think we reassessed it most mornings. Just to see. And then we would also move the staff around from pieces to pieces once they were on site anyway. But we were very careful with it.
We were very sensible as well with the hours we were working, because people assume of a short deadline that we would be working 24 hours round the clock. And we weren't. We were normal 9 to 5 hours. There was weekend working. But we're mindful that the team of our embroiderers, they do teach, they have their own lives as well. And to get the best out of everybody, it has to be really sensible working hours. And the techniques that we're using as well, gold work, can be quite hard on the eyes. So we were lucky with the multiple projects, we could rotate people around, and trusting, you know, the standard of work would still look like one. So we had lots of calendars and schedules on the go. It was a bit like Sudoku, working out who could go where. But it was fun. You know, we loved it.
And the staff are always really good, because they come in from one day to the next, and they don't always know which piece they'll be on that day. So they could be moved around. They may not actually see the finish of one section because they needed somewhere else. So, but, you know, everybody is very, very flexible, and that works so brilliantly well that, you know, we can't ask for any more.
It was quite fun though. Some days they'd go home and there'd be 6 projects on the go, and the next day there might be 8 projects on the go. So they didn't know what they were coming into. So it was.
Well, and we've talked to several of your graduates, and they all have their own lives and their own businesses. But I got to believe, for something like this, it's an absolute honor for them to even be asked, and they drop things and come running quickly.
Yes, we had quite a few who managed to reorganize things so that they could come in and work on this.
Now, is it a phone tree? Do we use a phone tree? Or no phone tree.
Okay, yeah. No phone tree.
So how do you rotate the people through? So it take a typical day. It's got to be a lot of meetings just to plan how many bodies you need, how many chairs. Take us through how that works, because that's got to be a challenge.
We obviously assessed, as I say, we checked every morning who was in. We would check at the end of the day so we knew who was coming in the next day. We'd have in our own minds who we were assigning to which project the next morning. And so we therefore knew where we were placing people. We have a huge selection of equipment, so catering for different people, the way different people want to sit. You know, we have a range of chairs, we have a range of lights, all of that. The lighting in the studio is brilliant anyway, but we do have the additional lights if anybody needs it. And we know our people really well, so we know often how they like, we know how they like to work, how they like to sit, you know, whether there's any issues. So we were able to cater for all of that, but it was very much planning sort of either end of the day, and then just Gemma and I in between other things, catching up in the middle of the day to see if there was any changes or any adjustment. And maybe if we thought of anything through the evening, there may be the odd WhatsApp going to and fro, but, you know, it's very much a case of planning carefully. But as I say, the studio is quite an adaptable space as well. It needs to be for different size projects coming through, regardless of coronation ones. So we're used to having that flexibility there.
And when it comes to the space and security, also fascinate me. So you have enough space there that you could cordon off all of this activity from your normal everyday activities?
We may have spread into the odd office or two.
Okay. Okay.
We have our classroom. So, you know, occasionally if there was a classroom free, then we may utilise that space for smaller pieces. Some pieces we couldn't move and they had to stay where they were. So it very much depended on the piece. And with regards to security, we're very fortunate here. We obviously come under the security of Hampton Court Palace. So that wasn't an issue.
Oh, that's good. Because, yeah, I would think in a normal situation, that would be a real concern with some of the pieces you have because they're valuable and old. Yes. So,
yes,
go ahead, Susan. Yes.
I was gonna say, we're used to looking after those pieces, and we even managed through the process to still have the pre-booked tours that people had booked months and months ago before we knew we were doing any coronation pieces. So we managed to move things around so that nobody would see what we were doing. And so to them, it was just an ordinary piece of work we were working on.
Yeah.
And that's what I was wondering, because, it wasn't just security, because, I've been to Hampton Court, and I know, you have to be walked in to get into the Royal School, but I was worried about, people seeing what you're doing, because it was kind of hush hush, people that you didn't want people to see it. So that's interesting that you were able to manage the tours and hide everything from them.
We have curtains up at the windows as well, which is not unusual because we have them up most of the year anyway. So in the instances, people wouldn't suddenly rumble, they've got barricades up. So yeah, we were very clever in how we hid what we were doing.
That's interesting too, because then that tells us that no matter what piece is in house, that you guys are absolutely used to just keeping it private, so that
we are definitely our discretion.
Yeah, so normal thing. No chair goes cold. Tell me about that. I love that that concept.
Never a seat shall go cold. I came up with that phrase, and we've had that. Well, I think probably since at least 1901, when we worked the funeral pall for Queen Victoria, where 45 women stitched for 21 continuous hours of stitching, because the pall was needed very, very quickly. So never a seat shall go cold, I think, comes from there.
So we have, how does that work then? Just there's got to be a mechanism to it. Somebody says, I need a break, and then there's always somebody waiting to step in.
Possibly. I mean, they may not be waiting, but it could be that one piece is wanted before another one. So if the piece that's wanting first, somebody needs a break, then we might move somebody off to keep that one going while they have a break. And then when that person comes back, they go back to where they were, or they take a break. So, we try and split the break times as well, because the studio has a no food and drink policy, obviously. So any breaks, the embroiderers come away from what they're doing. So that gives them time to just stretch and rest their eyes and just take a bit of a breather before they then go back. And that's, they have regular breaks like that. And that's an everyday thing. That's not just for the coronation. It's just, we move people around, obviously, when there's deadlines.
Yeah. Now, Anne and Gemma, throughout this process, you guys are responsible for the overall end product. Are you there all the time, or do you just need to check in from time to time on each of the projects?
Oh, no, we were here most of the time, I think.
So we're not like...
We're slowly morphing into each other. Aren't we? No, we were. We tried to split the weekends between us, but one or other of us was here every day.
Okay.
Continuity and standards, it's really, really important. And also for scheduling, we had to know those projects inside out. And yeah, so we were here a lot.
Yeah, somebody had to pay the price. I knew there was somebody along the way that was camped out at the palace. Yes. Yeah. Now, is that when you're doing that, is it a lot of course correction as the stitching goes on, or are the people, I mean, I know the people are good, there's no doubt about that, but is it just here and there where something needs to be reworked or adjusted?
Occasionally it happens. I mean, you know, you go a certain route and it doesn't work, so therefore you have to redo. So yes, from time to time it does happen. We try and have plenty of discussions, don't we, Gemma?
Yeah, and sampling as well is really important before we embark on anything. If we're unsure in any way, we will sample and practice, because there are more than one way to do different things. And what's great with the team as well, they talk, we develop as we're working. So if something isn't looking how we think it might or should be, we discuss, we go again, sample, and that's the best way actually to get a solution, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially the older pieces, when you got to do some repair or some upgrade or whatever, color matching concerns me. Is that a factor, or are the old pieces stored so well that colors don't shift?
There's always some movement in color, but we work really hard to try and match as near as possible to what we can, and that's why sometimes older stock is really helpful, because there's shades that perhaps aren't available now. So as Gemma says, you know, we do hoard, even if it's half a reel of thread or half a skein, but it might just be useful when we need it, and so we find that really helpful.
There were a few instances, and when, you know, as we go through the projects, you'll learn about it, but actually having the stock that we do meant in some instances it was real jackpot finds. So but I shan't say any more at the moment, but it's important having that stock, because it is difficult nowadays getting good quality products. So when we find good suppliers, we hold on to them, and yeah, we just make sure we've got the best of what we're using.
Yeah. So Susan, all these ladies have all done all this work, and actually there's a guy in there too. I was really excited to see an actual male in the process here. That's fantastic. Is at the end, does everybody gather to watch the coronation to see their work actually in action, or how did we wrap up?
Well, we wrapped up in different ways, because 20 of our people were invited by the Queen to sit in the bleachers the seating that was outside Buckingham Palace, to watch all the carriages coming and going. Now, that neither the royal family nor ourselves could anticipate that, of course, it was going to pour down that day. The RSN people are nothing if not intrepid, and they didn't move from their seats. We selected 20 of those who'd worked on the project, and they sat there and got some great images of seeing all the coming and going that was happening during the ceremony. And then Anne and Gemma were invited to the concert that was held that weekend. We had some great ways of celebrating it, whilst also being able to watch it, whether it was directly or on catch-up on the television.
Yeah. I can't imagine the thrill of even if you're at home sitting in front of the TV, to see what you worked on in such a huge event. That's got to be... Oh man, yeah, I can't even imagine how the heart starts to beat.
It's so tremendous, because anybody watching the main part, you could not fail to see work by the RSN, because there was just so much of it in the main arena, as it were. You know, the different chairs, the outfits that the King and Queen wore. You know, it was just everywhere.
Yeah.
There's such a huge sense of pride as well, and I think finally being able to say to friends and family what we've been doing, there's no feeling like it. It was really emotional, and just made you go through the year on now.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, let's take a look at some of the pieces you worked on and learn about them. So we'll start out with the the King's Robe of State. And if I get the terms wrong, let me know. But now this is one that obviously has some history to it.
Yes, it does. So it is known that this was worn by George VI for the coronation in 1937. But then quite an interesting thing happened because Anne had said to me that the fabric felt older. And those that you can see here, Marg and Jess, who are working on it, also thought the fabric felt older. And then I had a phone call from the deputy curator of the Royal Collection Trust. And she said, "Susan, have you got any information about this? Because I think this is older." So we had this little conversation. And although neither we nor Royal Collection have any information, we actually think it is older, and potentially it could go all the way back to Edward the VII in 1902. Wow. We're waiting to see if anybody else. There's a third party involved, a company called Eden Ravenscroft, who do the ermine and the lining. We're waiting to see if they've got anything in their archive which would inform us. It's fascinating that we came from that to that kind of same conclusion from different parts.
So with a piece like this and a coronation, then it sounds like this is an excellent opportunity to put heads together and build on the history of the piece, and document.
Yes, you would hope that there would be documents around. But as I say, if it does go that far back, it's perhaps not surprising that there are no documents. That's the nature of the thing. I mean, even for later, in terms of 1937, we have literally one piece of paper which tells us all that we did for the coronation in 1937. And that only came into us in about 2013. Record keeping as we know it today is a bit different from how it used to be.
Yeah, wow. So what are the ladies doing here? What kind of work did you have to do on this piece?
So in this image here, you can see Marg and Jess. So they are conserving the robe. So the piece, the actual section they're working on at the moment is a metallic braid. It was actually called a lace border, but they are securing it and stabilising it. Obviously, the robe is worn by His Majesty as he's in the carriage. So given its age, we had to make sure it was really strong, that it could withstand being moved and handled. There were pages carrying it. So securing those edges was really important. So they did that together. And we surface cleaned the robe, gently lifting any dust or anything that may be within the fibres, and just making it look its best, because it is that wow moment. As the king stepped out of the carriage and arrived at the abbey, all eyes were on him and on our work. So this is what they did here. So a real thorough inspection, front and back, and making sure everything was as secure and as strong as it could be.
And this obviously we've just talked about how old this is. I assume that when it is in storage, that it's the utmost of protection, that it comes out of storage in excellent shape.
Yes, it's kept by the Royal Collection Trust. And I should say that this is actually worn for more than just a coronation. For things like the state opening of Parliament as well, it would have been worn on a number of other occasions. But yes, it is kept and looked after by the Royal Collection Trust.
But you guys don't have to do work on it every time it's used.
We don't know yet.
Okay.
And then just a quick question. What are you working on there? Is it a big trestle or is it a table to hold it out?
Yeah, so because the train is so long, and all the lining had been removed so we could get to the edging there, so it is on tables, but sometimes we would work those kind of repairs on trestles as well. So it's just adjusting the process, but those are tables it's resting on.
Wow. All right, let's move on to the next one here. These just blow my mind, these... these are the we're called the ciphers. Help me understand when we say kings and queens ciphers.
Yes, so the king's and the queen's ciphers are their initials with a crown. And this the crown is interesting because Queen Elizabeth II used the Edward crown, which is has a sort of flatter top to it. And I have to say, when the king visited us, he told me that he'd gone back to this crown, which is known as the Tudor crown, and which has the more slopey sides to it. And then the king and the queen can choose the initials and the typeface that they have. So interestingly, the king's initials, the CR, are perhaps more similar to those of his mother, Elizabeth, quite a hard-edged typeface. Whereas for Queen Camilla, she had curly letters. There we are. And that's perhaps more reminiscent of Queen Elizabeth, better known to us as the Queen Mother, who, was, of course, was the wife of George VI. And on her robes in 1937, she had very curly E's for her Elizabeth. So it's more in the style of that for Camilla.
Now, these two pieces you created from scratch?
Yes, we did.
And so do you propose the design or does it get proposed to you?
No, so the design came from the College of Arms and was designed by a gentleman called Timothy Node, who did these. He also did Her Majesty's coat of arms for the throne chairs, and he worked in conjunction with us to produce the design for the Stole Royale.
And then the challenge for the team was that this amazing damask material that's in the background on the chairs, because the ciphers kind of had to fit well within that large pattern.
Oh, okay. So
the damask is specifically woven for the chairs. So it's a Torcello damask, and the shade is called Campari, which we thought was quite fun. we felt like we wanted a Campari by working. But it was fantastic. And as Susan said, we had to make sure those ciphers fitted perfectly within that pattern. The letters themselves have been worked in cloth of gold, in applique with couched edges and metal threads. The crowns were worked in the technique of silk shading. We were very fortunate because we were working multiple projects. We were able to draw elements from different projects together. So there was a sort of common link between them all. So the cloth of gold that was used for the chairs was also on the anointing screen. A little bit had been used in the robe of estate. So there was this kind of invisible tie to all of the projects together. It was really lovely. Just bringing them all together. And again, that was multiple embroiderers that had worked that. So the embroidery was worked on a separate frame, cut out, and then transferred onto the damask. And you then have the embroidery ready to be put on the chair frame by the upholsterers.
So this was worked right on the damask. It wasn't created and then applied after the fact. Wow.
No, it was worked separately and then applied to the damask.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm just admiring the stitch work here. Holy smokes.
Yes.
Silk shading is beautiful because it's referred to as painting with a needle. And I think when you look back, it does
look
like a piece
of art. It
works
really, really well.
And it's really striking. And these chairs then go into the throne room at Buckingham Palace. And they're so iconic. I mean, we were very lucky. We saw the late Queen and Duke of Edinburgh's throne chairs. And to now see these versions against them as well, it's quite something. It really is sort of you're seeing history right in front of your eyes. And as an embroiderer as well, seeing those pieces that had been worked previously, it's quite mind-blowing, actually, to sort of see and comprehend. But very special.
I would think that red background in the crown would have been very hard to choose considering the color of the chair.
Yeah,
we were able to work. We had color samples for the fabric, so we were able to work with those in order to get something that worked closely with the damask, but it is quite tricky when you've got red on red.
Yes, and that's what I was looking at it. When you look at it close, you're like, wow, that, because it looks, when you stand back, it's it almost blends in. It looks richer. You obviously have a richer color there. But when you get up close, I'm like, wow, how did they do that? How did they pick that color? Anyway.
But it's the highlights and the gems as well I really love, because it creates a sort of three-dimensional effect. And then you kind of get the effect of the ermine fur as well on the crown. Just with stitch, it's amazing. Mm. We've got a very clever team.
When you back up, you can almost make yourself believe those gems are actual stones. Yeah, it's very effective.
And the pearls on the round part. I thought at first they were. I was like, oh, they put pearls on. That would have been uncomfortable to sit on.
Well, those are because
they're symmetrical, to make sure they were really all round.
Yes.
Symmetrical and then even. Because I think if any one of them had been slightly off, we'd all be sort of twitching looking at it. So, checking and making sure everything is right. And it's worth mentioning as well, the process of transferring the design, because we get the artwork, it is painted on. So you make an accurate prick and pounce tracing. So all these processes that we've used at the school since, we began, we still use them because they are the most accurate way of transferring a design and getting that accuracy and definite, the definite edging. And it's lovely to use those skills and showcase them in this way on these projects. It was amazing.
I'm just going to take a moment here and just enjoy the needlework. It's just so precise and so beautifully done, and over all these shapes, curves, it's just so consistent too. It's just beautiful. I mean, we expect that, but still, it's just impressive. Care who you are or where you're at, it is just impressive to see that kind of skill. I mean, look at this overlap here, and to make that all hold together and look three-dimensional. Well, it is three-dimensional, but it's gorgeous.
Yeah, that braid that you used around there is beautiful. That very thick twist.
Yeah, it's known as a Grecian.
Mm. Wow. Okay, got to move on.
okay. Stop drooling.
All right. This is the anointing screen. I mean, this is a showpiece and a half. Tell about what this is, how it works, and this you also did from scratch. I mean, this is from a design that was given to you or that you created.
No, it was very much a collaboration. It was very much because the RSN had previously worked and produced canopies for the coronation. We didn't foresee anything quite like this at all. This really was out of the blue. Yes, absolutely. It was a gift from the City of London and the City Livery Companies. And we have a lovely connection with a lot of the livery companies. They're very supportive of our students and of the school in general. So it was lovely to be able to work with them. The design was by an iconographer known as called Aidan Hart, and he had already done some pieces for His Majesty. So he was very much His Majesty's choice as the designer. And it was based on the celebratory window at the Chapel Royal at St James's Palace, which was originally made to commemorate the late Queen's 60th anniversary. And it was all about the Commonwealth, very much about the Commonwealth. So the central panel, as you can see in the image here, has got the tree of, based almost on a tree of life. The leaves are showing the Commonwealth countries. And we've then got the birds, and we've also got roses, and the cipher at the bottom. It's His Majesty's cipher, and it's him giving back to the Commonwealth, and then there's a lovely motto at the bottom. Now, you can see that we've got this panel with the tree. We've also got two side panels, which both have crosses. And then what people hadn't maybe taken on board is inside, there's another three panels with crosses on. So there was five panels of large crosses and this one. But it was a collaborative project all the way through. So the leaves with the Commonwealth countries were worked by our community of students and staff. So we were able to get lots of people involved. So they were all sent out. A couple of the leaves went over to students that we have in Australia. And then they came back in my hand luggage. But I was out there anyway.
Very elite delivery.
But we also worked with the wooden frame, which the panels are all attached to, was produced by a fine furniture maker known as Nick Goodfreud. Mm-hmm. And he had produced them from oak that had been from a tree that had fallen down at Windsor. So that, again, sustainability. And the eagles were produced by a sculptor known as Tim Royal, and they were then gilded. So it was really lovely to work with all these parties. And the final person involved, who I must not forget, was Pete Tarrant, who did all the digital embroidery for the base of the tree. Mm-hmm. Because of the time factor, we had to think a little bit further than just hand embroidery. So the base of the tree, the trunk, the branches and the outside leaves and some of the internal leaves where they've got no countries on were all produced by digital embroidery. And we've worked with Pete before, so it was lovely to be able to work on a bigger project with him and embellish the machine embroidery with hand embroidery. So it was a really lovely combination. And we could work lots of the elements, so the leaves, the birds, the angels at the top, the dove, the star, all of that could be worked while we were waiting for other things to be done, and then it sort of all amalgamated together like a big jigsaw puzzle.
And Susan, it must have been a previous conversation you were talking about, you had to also do a mock-up for rehearsal, so it had to
We didn't do the mock-up, but a mock-up was made for the guardsmen who were going to be carrying this into Westminster Abbey. So just to make it a little bit harder for them, the mock-up was slightly harder to carry and slightly heavier, so that when the guardsmen actually got to the final thing, it was going to be slightly easier because it was easier to hold and didn't weigh quite so much. But they had extensive practices. And I think the other thing is, when the screen was here, it looked enormous at the RSN in our spaces. I was really quite surprised when people said that they had seen it on the Abbey, you know, in the coronation, and they didn't realise how big it was when they finally saw it at Buckingham Palace. And I did realise how big it was, and I knew immediately that looking at these guardsmen, I could tell that they would at least be over 6 foot. And the Sergeant Major, who is in the left with his back to us, he's very tall indeed. I've met him. And I said to him, I think you had quite tall people carrying it, the screen in. And he said, absolutely. Average height was 6'4". So that will give you a clue that this is over 7 feet high. You know, it's not a small piece at all. Yeah. And that's why they kind of had to practice how much, you know, carrying it in and out, because it had to be so smooth. And just, you know, you almost didn't realise it had arrived and it was there. And then again, when it was taken away, it had to be very smoothly done.
It's so impressive. Now, did you guys, you did obviously all the embroidery work, did you also finish the panels with the loops for the staffs and all that, or is that someone else that does that?
We did all of that. So we worked with Nick with the drawings that he'd done for sizing and prep. He'd worked out the sections on the poles where it would dip in, where the ties would go round. It's all on there with Velcro, because Velcro works very good for textiles. It supports it throughout. So that's how it's on there. But no, we work very, very closely with Nick in order to get that working right. It is, again, edged in cloth of gold, so that follows through. And you have cloth of gold and cloth of silver on the top section where the sun is.
Oh, the precision, because, I mean, you don't want it to look droopy or wrinkled or anything. It's gorgeous.
It's a soft hanging at the end of the day, so there will be some movement in it, but it does fit really well. Yeah. And we've even worked little eyelets on the tabs where they go over the bolts that bolt the frame together. And then Nick built storage cases for it. So then we've worked out a way that it must be rolled and stored and so forth. So all of those instructions are done. So it was very much from start to finish.
I was wondering about that. Is it stored by the, who stores this piece?
So the Royal Collection Trust have it.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment.
We are hoping it might be put on exhibition, but we're waiting to hear.
Oh, that would be great, because I was going to ask, is this a one-time use thing? Of course, you don't know when the next coronation is going to be, so I guess you really don't know, but is the expectation this is a one-use thing, and then the next time there will be a different anointing panel?
Impossible to know. No, impossible. I mean, obviously, we made the 1902 canopy, and that was used again in 1911. And then we made the 1937 canopy, and that was used again in 1953. So who knows? This could be used again next time. Hard to tell.
Yeah. Okay, now we got, this is the, I want to get on to this one here. So then all these branches then are the digital embroidery.
They are, yes, yes. And we all worked very, very closely with Aidan to sort of realise his vision. So he worked very closely with Pete in order to get the branches going under and over where he wanted them. The birds, they were had to be worked in a certain way. He had very specific thoughts. And we do joke because our angels, they have the most perfect eyebrows of anybody.
Oh, so we gotta have a look. Hang on.
We often talk about their eyebrows.
Okay, there we go.
They're beautiful. So it was just lovely to work with another artist. So the screen was very different to the other projects in the fact that it was such a collaborative project to be working with delivery companies as well as other companies as well. So.
Gorgeous. And we got our male stitcher. We got to get him in the deal here.
Don't worry, Matt, stitching away.
And this is the star that hangs over the top.
It is, yeah. And that's just a combination of cloth of gold and cloth of silver.
Yeah. Wow.
It really catches the light beautifully. And I think in any venue, especially if it's in a church-related venue, with the lighting, it just really plays off the fabric as well as the edgings.
Yeah. Oh, it's just a nice, up there at the top.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful. Wow, what a piece. That alone, the pride you guys must have creating that. Wow.
Yeah.
And then that's kind of the key moment in the coronation, right? When the king is behind there, what happens behind there? Do we know?
It is the anointing of the king. So it's the most sacred part of the ceremony. The moment then, after which he is then crowned.
Yes. So this, to build the panel for that moment. Wow. All right, moving on. Help me with the stole. This stole is fascinating.
So this is the Stole Royal, and this is the gift of the Worshipful Company of Girdlers, who are one of our city livery companies, girdlers being belt makers, but they have for a long time given this gift to the monarch, so as I say, we made a previous one for them in 1911, so they offered this gift to the king, and he then had to say yes or no, and then it had to be designed.
So the design, again, was by Timothy Node, and we worked very closely with him and the girdlers to make sure that all the iconography on there was correct. There were different options, different colourways. What's really lovely is on the nape of the stole is a gridiron, which is the symbol for St. Lawrence, who is the patron saint of the girdlers. So it was lovely to have that nod. There's a very special, as you go higher up towards the shoulders on, at the neck, there are two roundels, which are a pattern taken from the Cosmati paving in the Abbey. So it has that tie into that. You've got the four evangelists there, so Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, the dove for the Holy Spirit, cross keys of St. Peter, and then the national emblem, so England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales. And they're really lovely because they were sort of like miniature pieces of artwork. That they were so tiny, but the detail within them. So you've got there the rose for England. They were worked in silk floss, so from our stock of materials, so we were able to use those. And what's lovely, the edging, the raised Grecian and gimp thread there that was used, they form a chain, which is like a belt. So it's linking back to the girdlers. So there were all these sort of discreet symbolism caught within. But it was very important that the king, you know, had his input. So he was able to choose the colourways and the positioning of the roundels that he liked. So there was mock-ups of colourways and things, and we sort of corresponded with the palace. And then we were able to produce, this is one of my favourite pieces because I think the detail within those emblems is just incredible. And you've got there again, you've got some of the freshwater pearls that were used on the anointing screen and on Her Majesty's robe of estate. So again, you're just tying all these pieces together in some subtle ways.
So did you stitch the pieces on to the girder, or was it applique on the little rondelles?
Yeah, so the roundels were worked individually on separate frames, but some of the elements, so the national emblems, the metal chain work, were worked directly onto the cloth of gold base fabric. So yeah, we had to make sure that it was, the positioning of those was symmetrical, that it was all lined up, so that when it was worn, that they were in a really good position. What's lovely as well is all the figures and the eagles face in towards the king's heart. So we had to make sure when we were mirroring and transferring the design on that everything was mirrored. So there was a lot of proof checking of that. Waking up in the middle of the night going, I'll just have one more look in case.
I can imagine.
Because it's such a spectacular piece. And what's lovely, this can be used again. It's very special.
That fear that the day of you miss something. Oh, no, thanks. All right. Now the chairs here. I did not write down who the lady was. This is a stock photo, but these two chairs are just so impressive.
So these are the chairs with the crests, and the interesting thing here is that the king's crest was originally worked by us in 1937. And in order to have two chairs that now matched, it had to be cut out from the original backing fabric. But I shouldn't say it, I should say they, because there is one on the front and one on the back.
Oh.
So we cut them out completely, very neatly, and then reapply them onto the new fabric, because the Queen, the consort, always has a different crest because different lineage. And so Queen's crest was designed by the Royal College of Arms. And then again, we had to work two of those side by side.
Okay, Susan, I'm going to display my absolute ignorance here. Which one is the king?
The king is on the left.
On the left, okay.
Yes.
Sorry, I just, I don't know.
Okay, and it just shows we take that for granted. So there, yes, there's the kings and with the lion and the unicorn and the crest in the centre with the, again, the more lions representing the coat of arms of Britain. And so, yes, that's for the king. And then, so the queens is the new one because, you know, each queen, in the same way that Elizabeth in 1937, she had her own crest as well. So a new one is done for the queen. But as I say, two copies had to be made. So the challenge of that was...
So we were able to work them. They were worked separately, so they weren't worked straight onto the velvet. It had quite a deep pile. So they were worked separately, but we had them next to each other. So whoever was working on them, so we would have two at a time on the new coats of arms, and they would be working, as you can see, side by side there. And wherever possible, perhaps whoever worked the head of the boar would then work the head of the boar on the other one, or the claws, or if we could tie it up, but that didn't always happen. So there was lots of details and notes left, messages for whoever was coming on next. So if somebody had been on it for the day, knew they weren't in the next day, they'd leave a whole string of messages and anything they felt relevant to pass on. So lots of post-it notes, lots of notes left. Each other just to pass on the information, and we obviously would catch up with each of the projects at various points through the day so that we could then pass that information across. So it's a combination it's basically long and short with some satin stitch in there. Some of the lions are absolutely tiny, and as Gemma explained earlier on, the designs were painted on. So the team member that painted on the lions, I think it was something like 80 something claws, yeah, she painted across the whole of one of the coats of arms, and then had to do it again. Yeah. Which
she held her breath the whole time she was painting on.
She did. So it is quite difficult to do a repeat, because obviously, you know, things change slightly. But we did what we could to mitigate any huge contrasts, and I don't think you can spot them if there are any.
So I have. Do you all keep the notes that the students made as they went along for your archive, for your personal archive?
We have an inordinate amount of notes, and Gemma kept a diary, which is fabulous. So we have got that, but I think some of it we haven't even got to this day written up yet for the archive. But we will put a box together eventually of everything with as much information that we can put in there. Very much.
I do just want to point out that these were worked by our professional embroiderers. They're not students. They've long graduated. So here we have four of our professional embroiderers working on this.
Yeah, this is just so illustrative of the collaboration and the teamwork that goes into this work. It's
absolutely. And there's all generations coming together, past apprentices and past future tutors as well, even within that picture. Mm-hmm. So that was great to be able to bring those generations back. So once they'd been worked on that base fabric, they then had to be cut out and applied to the velvet, and then edged. So it then looked like the monarch's coat of arms, which had been transferred onto the velvet. So they have that same look about them. They have the same couched edge, and they have the same height to them as well. So we paired them up that way. And then just to add to it, there was the four white roses front and back of the chairs, which had to be done as well. They were transferred onto to new velvet and remade.
Oh, yeah, I was going to ask about, that's these down here.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
So those were, again, from the chairs in 1937, because prior to becoming George VI, Bertie had been the Duke of York. So the insignia of the Duke of York is the white rose. So that's why they had white roses there rather than the Tudor rose, appropriate for the people then. But as they were still in really good condition, it was agreed that they'd be reused again.
It's interesting to me because I start looking around the edges. I mean, it always padding and cloth here to rest your arms on. And is that DMC?
It may well be a mixed. If we wanted to run through a color range, then we will go between DMC and Anker. Certainly okay. For the arms, for the stole, we used silk instead. So we used a mix because it was that little bit finer to do those tiny little round doors.
But we always dress slate frames with acid-free tissue and Tyvek because it protects the piece. You'll see when we work larger projects, sometimes we rest our arms on wooden slats, so we're not leaning into the work. We don't have any sort of sharp tools on the embroidery. It's just making sure it's looked after the best it can be.
I just love this shot because it just shows everything. You know, the tools, the technique, the way the ground cloth's prepared. Two people working on the same thing and you won't be able to tell the difference.
Right. And in the middle of something on the front of the screen, the lettering is obviously someone stopped there and working on it. That's just fascinating me too.
Pin stitches.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It could be for a number of reasons. It could be that we were just testing that gold in and amongst the blue. Or it could be that the person working that was going to then come back to it when they were next on it the next day. So there might be a various reasons why the others aren't continuing with that.
Fascinating. All right. Now this one. This one. Wow. Wow. The Queen's robes.
This is the one where we were asked to come up with the design as well as stitching it. So I got the first call about this back in about end of October, and I contacted Anne immediately and said, you have a meeting tomorrow. And Anne and Gemma headed off.
So we had that initial meeting, and there were some discussions about possible design ideas. We're fortunate that Her Majesty has been our patron since 2017. So we have had some, she's been to visit us twice prior to all of this. So we had some understanding of her likes and her hobbies and such things like that. So we bore that in mind, and we had a small team putting together the design ideas, which Gemma can tell you a little bit more about.
Yeah, so it was really important. We wanted to make this really personal because it is such a special piece. So we spent a lot of time researching interests and hobbies of Her Majesty. Gardening was an obvious choice, and it lent us such scope for being able to create something one-off, bespoke, special for her, but also showcase the best of our skills and our abilities. And gold work is so exciting. I mean, it is, I remember training as an apprentice, it's what you were desperate to try because it seemed sort of really magical. And there, how did the threads work? How did you get to create these special effects? But what we did was we created something very personal, very modern, very fresh, still traditional in the techniques, but we had a play around. There's insects in there, there's colour. But we pulled on, we have some expert gardeners in the studio, so we pulled on their knowledge of flowers. We had to make sure that everything had a meaning, had a purpose. It wasn't just there as a filler. It resonated with Her Majesty and the King. So you'll see delphinium is the birth flower of July, which is when the Queen has her birthday. But it's also one of the King's favourite flowers. You've got Lily of the Valley, which were from the late Queen's wedding bouquet. Oak leaves, symbolising strength, endurance. The national flowers, so at the top of the robe you've got the shamrock, the daffodil, the rose and the thistle, myrtle, which is symbolic of the month of May. So when the coronation took place, one of our favourite flowers to be the pincushion flower. It's a very gentle nod to the Queen being our patron, and I think quite a touching sentiment, actually, because she is a fantastic patron for the school. You know, she's been to see us, she's so engaged with everybody when she comes. So to create this for her was such a privilege, and we just really wanted to make something wow, a showstopper. And I think we have.
And I think because we have all our brilliant expert embroiderers, and as I said earlier, they are practicing professionals. So, you know, this is 70 years on from the last robe. So we wanted to show that gold work has moved on. Mm. Gold work has become a little bit more contemporary, a little bit softer, a little bit freer, not so solid. So we pushed the boundaries a little bit. We had three dimensional areas. So on the pincushion flower, some of the petals are actually loose, so they're like looped metal threads. All the insect wings are loose, they're not fully stitched down, so they're three-dimensional. You've got three-dimensional centres in some of the flowers. Mm. We've used fabrics, we've applied fabrics like cloth of gold, metallic tissues. We've used some gold kid as well. And then we've used gold metallic beads, and we've used freshwater pearls and sea pearls, which all of those have not been done on a robe before. So we really did want to show how different gold work could be, but still be traditional, still be as amazing and as effective as it has always been, but just with a little bit more of a contemporary twist to it. So with all the knowledge that we were able to draw from our own professional practices as well as the teams, we worked really, really closely to find different ways to produce textures and finishes. And there was a lot of sampling for this, all of which will go into the archive for the future. Some of the sampling worked, some of it didn't. You know, that's the way it goes. But it was so important that we went through those processes. And you can just see the pearls there on the dandelion. And they just add, in particular, they add a little sort of break in the gold and a little bit of a highlight with that lovely finish that they have.
To me, it adds a little whimsy too.
But it was very much a lighter weight, freer feel to it, a little bit, very much more of today rather than the more regimental form of the previous robe.
Mm-hmm. Just cruising around this thing, you guys didn't miss a trick. I love the little snail down there.
You found the ladybird, yeah?
Yeah.
We've got ladybirds, we've got butterflies, beetles,
everything, bees. Yeah. What fun.
Are a nod back to their interest in sustainability and the ecosystem as well. So,
what a work of art. Wow.
Just amazing.
Look at the little guy right there.
The cipher, which was worked separately and applied to the robe.
So here we get to see a little of the padding here. Okay.
Yeah. What's really special about the cipher is when you work any project, you work from the center out, and you roll out the frame as you go. Obviously, we had to keep progressing the outer border. So when it came to applying the cipher, it was quite fun, actually, wasn't it? We had to cut out, once it had been completed on this frame, we had to cut it out and transfer it into the centre bottom there. So what you had was, because the frame had been rolled out by this point, you had somebody on the top of the frame, a taller member of staff, shall we say, and then those taller members of the team underneath the frame and the needle was passed from the top to the end of the side. So we've got some really lovely memories and images of that for ourselves just to sort of think about. But it's adaptable. So yeah, it's interesting to find where you are on the height chart, the RSN, just if you're on the top of the frame or underneath.
Well cushioned under.
Absolutely.
Wow. And how long is it? How many meters?
Four meters. 4 meters.
Mm. Okay. Wow. 12 feet plus.
Mm. Wow. But every time you look at it, you notice something else. Even still now, as you're sort of scrolling through the images, you pick up different details. And what's lovely, when the light hits it at different points of the day, there was movement in it. It was, yeah.
It's when we took many of our RSN friends to see it at Buckingham Palace when it was on display last summer, it was fantastic to get their reactions to it, because we were able to see it really close up. Mm. And it was just fantastic. I went 6 times and I was enjoying seeing it while I was leading the team. So, but it was fantastic to see it. And yeah, it does have immense movement in it.
Yeah.
But I know that people will enjoy watching this and they watch it more than once. But for our 150th anniversary, I produced the book called An Unbroken Thread. And I was told a few months ago that it was selling out. So I went back to them and said, could I add an extra chapter? So we have. It's just come out, the new version. If I might, I will give you, because it's quite heavy. So
here, I'm going to put you back on screen now.
Okay.
Whoops, not that one. Oh, that one. There
yes.
we go.
There we are. And I'll put it front and center. So this is the new edition of the book, and it's got lots of pictures in it. So you can see, again, some of the things that we've been talking about in this hour. And there is a US distributor, so it's US sales at accartbooks.com, and you can go there and get copies more locally, or if you're watching from anywhere else, the RSN online shop has copies just coming in as we speak. So for people who want to have a look at those images for a little bit longer, we've got images of each of the pieces that we worked on for the coronation in there.
Give that address again, please, Susan.
This is US sales, all one word, at accartbooks, all one word, .com.
Okay. And so we can get a copy of that book without the overseas shipping cost then.
That's right. And it's called An Unbroken Thread.
Okay, now is the one where you've added the chapter, is that like version 2, or how do we designate that to make sure we get that one?
In America, it's the only one available.
Oh, okay, okay.
We sold out, and all the copies that were still in America came back to us. So now this will be coming out as the new edition, it should be on its way to the States as we speak now.
Okay, because I want the new one. Yes. All right, ladies, thanks so much. Oh, one more question. Now, after the coronation and all the things are done, do the pieces come back to you for to be checked to make sure everything is still intact, or how is that handled, or do they just go into storage?
They go into storage. They go to the Royal Collection Trust, who will check them over anyway. And then they will store them in the most appropriate way they can. So,
okay. So you don't see them anymore after they leave you?
No, which is why Gemma and I helped Susan on numerous occasions at the exhibition at Buckingham Palace, just so that we get a few.
Well, and I got to believe that months afterwards, to go back, you know, when you don't have the pressure of meeting deadlines, to be able to go back and just enjoy them as needle art has got to be a whole different experience.
Absolutely, it was. And of course, we were able to take our families to see them as well. So right. Again, they knew what we'd been up to then.
Yeah. Yeah, all those nights and weekends that I was gone is I was actually doing something.
Yes.
Yep. Well, ladies, thanks so much. Wow. What a story. Yeah. Really impressive. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thanks. Bye.